Welcome to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast. Every 2 weeks, we explore news and issues affecting hunters, anglers, and conservation across the northeastern United States. If you enjoy the content here, be sure to subscribe to our print or digital versions by calling 800-535-5191 or visit our website at outdoornews.com. Now, here's your host and a man who claims he's immune to buck fever, New York Outdoor News editor Dan Ladd.
Greetings and welcome to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. Happy to be along as we're turning the corner on February here, into February, I should say, which means it's Groundhog Day or it's around Groundhog Day. We're not quite there yet at the time of this recording, but it's a fun holiday, something we like to associate with the weather, anything like that us outdoor folks kind of like. We don't know if old Punxsutawney Phil is going to see his shadow yet or not. Perhaps by the time you listen to this, we'll have known what's going on down there in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and whether we're going to have six more weeks of winter or not, or whether you believe all that stuff or not. Again, it's just fun. If you're an outdoors person, you like the weather. I'm a kind of a weather freak myself and enjoy things like that. And of course, I like watching it on the Weather Channel and all the good time those people are having down there around this holiday, something they do to break cabin fever. Hey, we've got quite an episode lined up for you here today. The heart of it is going to be spent on talking about reloading. We're actually going to go back in time to a previous podcast with Robin Sharpless from Redding Reloading here in New York and going to share some of the things he shared with us not quite a year ago when we had him on episode 17 around the end of March of 2023, but we're going to talk about a book he co-authored as well as some of the basic steps of the hand loading process. And we're going to talk more about that ahead of our flashback with Robin. But first, we'll catch you up on some news and a few other things, and we'll get right back to that right after this.
If you know a kid who loves to hunt and fish, tell them to check out the Outdoor News Junior Pro Team. The Junior Pro Team is about becoming a pro and sharing your photos, videos, and tips. There's members-only discounts. Plus, members can win gear with our weekly drawings. Membership to the Junior Pro Team is free, and kids get a decal, window cling, and membership card when they join. Check out the Outdoor News Junior Pro Team on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and join the team online at juniorproteam.com.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News, and we've got a few things we want to talk about before we get into our key subject, which is the basics of hand loading. You know, when we first started this podcast, we used to do some news reports from around the Northeast and just kind of catch up on a few things. And we've kind of gotten away from that. I do tend to talk about it a little bit during our intro, but just a couple of things to touch base on. And I'm going to go back to our previous podcast, our mid-January episode with Captain JJ. We talked a lot about ice conditions, and obviously, we're having another real mellow winter here. I guess from a deer hunting perspective, that's a good thing because it's going to do well for our deer herds, especially in the mountainous areas where food coming into this winter was certainly an issue. We had a lack of mass crop in a lot of areas, and maybe this is just a way of nature playing itself out. But in terms of winter fun, winter recreation, especially anything you're going to do on the ice, definitely requires some attention. Ice safety has been paramount. Here in New York, there's been ice fishing tournaments, cancellations dropping like flies, including a couple bigger ones. There's usually a big tournament in Tupper Lake in the Northern Adirondacks called the Northern Challenge that usually takes place the first Saturday in February. That tournament has been canceled, and to my knowledge, that is the first time that has ever happened. A year ago, a similar tournament in Scroon Lake, which takes place in early March, that was canceled for the first time last year. And I think as we speak right now, we're looking at things up there in Scroon Lake and hoping that one can come off. But who knows? Another tournament that's on the fence right now as we speak is one over on the Great Sacandaga Lake. It used to be called the Great Sacandaga Reservoir in the very southern tip of the Adirondacks. And all across New York, folks, there's been issues with ice. As we said in the last episode, we lost an ice angler down in Otsego County. Him and his brother fell through the ice. We've heard there wasn't even a couple inches in that case. That's a report that we got. There's been some folks went through the Connecticut River over on the New Hampshire-Vermont line, out in Seneca Falls in central New York, the Finger Lakes region. A woman went through the ice trying to rescue her dog. Unfortunately, the dog perished. Going back to last year, we lost some folks in the Taconic State Park, Lake Champlain. You know, we're basically just, it's deja vu all over again for the ice last year and this year. And I say that, you know, we're coming into issue number 3 of New York Outdoor News, and we do have some ice fishing content there. And some folks say, well, why are you putting ice fishing content out when we don't have a lot of safe ice? Well, you know, we're hoping that we might get some weather. It can change on a dime if we get some cold weather, and there can be some ice fishing opportunities, although it may be isolated, smaller ponds, shallow bays, for example. And there are people out there doing it, but, you know, our message is to please, please be careful. The more you know about a certain body of water, the more you understand the current, springs, things like that, the better off you are. Myself, I'm hoping to get out there before the winter's over, but I'll be honest with you, I haven't even attended to any of my ice fishing gear yet, and that's something I usually do around the holiday season. So we've got some free fishing days coming up in New York, President's Day weekend. We've got similar programs going on in states like Vermont. And we just hope that these things are able to come off and come off safely. We know there's a winter break coming up for college students and high school students, and families will be getting together and recreating on the ice if they can. And we just hope that can happen and that you're able to enjoy winter in some sort of fashion. Moving on, the National Rifle Association trial down in New York City. We've been watching this in New York Outdoor News the best we can. Remember, we're a biweekly publication. The now resigned CEO, Executive Vice President, former, I should say, Wayne LaPierre, he testified the same week we recorded this podcast. He did admit to some expenditures, did say it was business-related, basically defended himself. I don't know how y'all feel about this trial. I've been a NRA member for most of my adult life, and I just have not liked what's been going on the last few years, ever since Oliver North stepped down, and he took the stand as well in this trial the week prior, and he really had a lot to say. And I'm not going to get into the details of that here because the trial is changing every day. There's still a lot to be heard, and this court of public opinion can be a tough one. So we're going to let the court, the real court, play this scenario out. I do urge you to follow it. And personally, I'm not giving up on the NRA. I'm hoping that what comes out of this trial is some new leadership and some forward-looking leadership and something that gets back into programs like Eddie Eagle and the women's programs and youth programs, Friends of the NRA, while at the same time, you know, supporting gun rights on a political front. We need all of that, and hopefully we can have all of that going forward. And, you know, basically this organization is going to be challenged with the task of earning back the trust of its members and its former members. And that's all remains to be seen. I mean, then that's where we're at. And again, I'm just watching the trial, and I don't know what's going to come out of it. A couple other items here, something to keep an eye on. The National Deer Association came out with this earlier this week over in Vermont, Senate Bill 258, what they say would transfer the authority to adopt rules for taking fish and wildlife, including fur-bearing animals, in Vermont. They would take the authority from the Fish and Wildlife Management Board and place it with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The bill would also amend the authority of the Fish and Wildlife Board so that it serves in an advisory capacity only to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. In addition, the bill would prohibit the hunting of coyotes with dogs and bait. Now, the reasoning they're putting this out there is currently the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Board considers amends and votes on rules that govern management of fish and wildlife. That means that hunters and anglers are the ones, and trappers are the ones making this decision. S-258 would strip that authority from the board and give it to the, make them an advisory-only authority. And the other thing they want to do is reduce the number of people on that board from 14 to 12 and have some members appointed by the commissioner. Folks, this is a scary thing. Maybe what we don't realize, we like to think that our state wildlife commissions are hunters and anglers, and I think for the most part they are. But as some of our biologists and foresters and folks like that begin to age out, you know, we're seeing younger folks that may not have a hunting or fishing background. Here in Vermont, you have actual hunters, anglers, and trappers making these decisions, and I think that's the way we would want it to be going forward. So, again, just an alert there for our friends over in Vermont, and heads up as things like this pop up in your state. One more note, sports show season is upon us, and it's a great time of year if you're trying to get out and cure a little cabin fever. New York Outdoor News is hitting several of these, as is Pennsylvania Outdoor News. I believe they're going to have a booth down at the Great American Outdoor Show, which is getting underway really soon. That's the big old Harrisburg show, and that's February 3rd to 11th in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And that is one of the biggest shows, if not the biggest show, in the entire northeastern region. I almost made the trip down there for that one, but some things came up, and I'm not going to be able to make that trip. I believe it's a commitment. It's a hard show to see even in a couple of days, but anyone that's ever been has really enjoyed it, and I'm sure they will this year. And if you're there, make sure you stop by the Pennsylvania Outdoor News booth. That's the sister publication to New York Outdoor News. Say hello, and maybe get yourself a subscription or renew your subscription. If you do that, they probably will give you a free hat. That's what we do here in New York, and we've got some shows coming up as well. February 15th to 18th, we're going to be at the Greater Niagara Fishing Expo at the Greater Niagara Fishing Expo. Spit it out, Dan, at the Convention Center in Niagara Falls. NiagaraFishingExpo.com is the website for that one. And then the last weekend in February, I should say, February 22nd to 24th is the New York Farm Show at the State Fairgrounds in Syracuse. Retired editor Steve Pyatt, who we've had on this podcast, will be manning the booth for that one. And the website for that is NewYorkFarmShow.com. And then myself and Megan Postal, we will be at the Adirondack Outdoorsman Show in Johnstown, New York, Southern Adirondacks area. That's going to be a great little show. I've attended it many times, and it's great to go over and rub shoulders with folks. And the website for that one is 80kshow.com. Of course, that same weekend, the 23rd to the 25th, is the Springfield Sportsman Show in Springfield, Massachusetts. So you got a lot of options there, folks. If you want to get out and cure cabin fever, we certainly urge you to do that. See what's new out there in the industry. Say hello to some friends, and just enjoy the outdoor world on the inside. Okay, we're going to get down to the reloading talk when we come back right after this.
I'm Matt Johnson from Clam Outdoors. When I'm looking for solid information to stay on good bites, I look to fishingreports.outdoornews.com. This website has the most up-to-date reports for 11 states in our region, from the Dakotas all the way to New York. Reports are compiled from the region's top pros and experts, including me and others from the Clam Pro team, plus gear reviews, pro tips, lake maps, and much more. Subscriptions start at just $2 per month. Get on top of the bites in your area with fishingreports.outdoornews.com.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News, and I guess I buried the lead this time around. Spent too much time babbling before, but we're going to talk about reloading, and the point of this podcast for the remainder of it is basically to say that anyone can take up hand loading. It's really a great hobby, and I am walking, living proof of this because I've only been at it for a short time, and that's what I wanted to share with you, along with some basically flashbacks to a podcast we did not quite a year ago with Robin Sharpless, and we'll get to that right towards the end here. First of all, how this came about for me, and I'm just using myself as an example because I've got a feeling a lot of folks out there feel the same way. In fact, I know that from talking with people all the time about this. I felt the same way that many of you do. I always found the idea, the concept of reloading to be interesting, and I kind of had a feeling that the day would come when I would do it. And I can remember talking with Robin Sharpless, who I've known through the New York State Outdoor Writers Association on many occasions. He is the vice president of Redding Reloading over in Cortland, New York. They make some fine reloading equipment and some of the best in the industry. And I'm not just saying that. Basically, anybody that understands reloading, veteran reloaders will tell you that. Anyways, Robin always told me, hey, when the time comes, you just let me know and we'll help get you started. And that's exactly what happened. But prior to that, you know, every time I would read some of the outdoor magazines and that I've, you know, collected over the years, anytime there was a story about hand loading, especially if it was for a round that I hunted with, like 30-30, 30-06, and now the 444 Marlin, those always interested me and how I could make my own rounds, maybe save some money, or maybe come up with a more accurate or better performing round on deer. And that is my purpose for reloading, is I basically want, I want to have hunting ammunition for one thing. We'll get to that in a second. But the other is that I want to have good performing hunting ammunition. Not that the factory loads don't, believe me. I mean, I've done well by them, the ones that I use. And but at the same time, you know, there's all kinds of ways you can tighten up your groups and become a better shot, you know, by practicing at the reloading bench. So probably around that time that I started talking with Robin about it, I started saving my brass. Any time I went to the range to sight in my deer rifles or just spent a little bit of a time there, you know, target practicing or whatever, I started saving my brass to the point where I have probably around 200 rounds of 30-30 shells, 30-30 cartridges, I should say, that's the proper terminology, that have been fired through my lever gun. I shoot a small Winchester Model 94 Trapper 30-30 with a peep sight. That's my Adirondack deer killer. And I've got close to 200 rounds that have been put through that gun and only that gun, which is a good thing when it comes to reloading because you're helping to form fit those cases to your barrel. I do have some other 30-30s that I've acquired through the years, and I've still got some more rounds to shoot and get more brass. So I've got quite a lot of 30-30 brass. I've also got quite a bit of 30-06 brass that I've collected. That's my Southern Zone gun that I've used for coyote hunting as well, and but mostly Southern Zone deer hunting. And I've been acquiring some 444 brass as I've only had that gun for a few years. Bottom line is I've been collecting brass, and that's what you want to do if you think you're going to do this someday, is save as much brass as you can, because as Robin will say later on, that's your biggest expense when it comes to components. If you've got to go out and buy brass, you're going to spend more on that per case than you will, or I should say per round, than you will on primers and powder and you know, those types of components. So another thing that happened was probably about the same time, I had an elderly friend who moved out of his home into an assisted living situation, and his stepdaughter, who's a very close friend, showed up at the house one day with this box, and inside the box was all of this reloading stuff. To me, I couldn't tell what any of this was. I just knew what it was. And so I set that aside, and then about 3 years ago, I started looking at this stuff and started figuring out what this was. And as it turned out, there was an old press there, a reloading press, a single stage press made by a company called Pacific. And Pacific was eventually bought out by Hornady, I believe. And in the day, the 1950s, it was a solid press. I have since refurbished this press, and I'm actually using it. It still works, and I had to get a shaft for it. That's a whole different story. I won't even go into that technicality. Bottom line, I was able to bring this press back to life, and it works just as well today as it did 50, 60 years ago. The gentleman's name is Whippy, by the way. That's what we call him. His real name is Bob Whitmore, and he's still sharp as a tack in his 90s. And he really was quite the firearms guy in his day. And there's just a lot of great stuff in there for hand loading 38 Special, which is what I shoot in my one of the firearms I shoot as well. And he was also loading 45 ACP at one time. But I stuck with the 38 Special, and that's where I kind of began when I began to reload. So anyways, what the final straw for me getting into reloading was COVID. Basically, during COVID, the flurry hit and you couldn't find ammunition anywhere. And back in 2020, that first year that we were dealing with it, I was running low on 30-30 ammo coming into deer season. And once I did find it, fortunately, I was able to find a couple of boxes to, you know, sight my firearm in and have a little backup, you know, for years, future years, should this continue. I paid out the nose for it. Most expensive ammunition I've ever bought. And that's when I said to myself, it's time to think about this reloading thing. So I was writing a story for New York Outdoor News about reloading, got talking with Rob and said, now's the time. So I acquired the equipment that I needed. The core is a reloading press. So I have a turret press, which is not just a single, it is a single stage press, but allows you to turn your dies. Anyway, it's a fine press, and that's the core of my reloading components. I also got a really good powder measurer from Redding and a lathe for trimming cases along with the needed dies. Then I started shopping for powder and reloads, and this is really what it comes down to. You can have all the equipment you want. You can have the best equipment, but you got to learn how to use it, and you have to learn how to basically load the rounds you're going to load in a safe manner. So one of the first things I did even before I got the equipment was just about 2 years ago at this time, we went through a kitchen remodeling project in my home. My wife got herself a new kitchen, and what I got out of it was a hunk of old countertop that would make a great reloading bench, which I set up in my basement, along with an old gun rack that belonged to my dad, which has some cabinets in it, and a few other things. So basically, I set myself up with a space to do this, and that's one of the things you'll need to do as well. And then once I started once I decided that I was going to be committed to this, that's when I started to read. And I'm still reading, folks. In fact, I've spent a lot of time reading this winter. Just about a year ago, I got comfortable enough to start some reloading, and the first thing I did was load straight wall 38 special rounds for one of my handguns. That was simple, easy, and again, the research and the reading, along with some brain picking from friends of mine who reload. And let me say, the folks who reload are a wonderful group of people. I mean, if you walk into a gun shop or your gun club or whatever and start talking to people or some of the online forums, there's some really helpful people out there. But really, it's that data in those books, and all of them will tell you that, the ones that I trust anyways, will tell you that what's in those books is there for a reason, especially when it comes to loads and not exceeding maximum loads and things like that. And that's where people tend to get intimidated by this. And that's where the books will guide you. So I'm still reading, and I've read a lot this winter. And I mean reading everything I can over and over and over. Quick sample. You want to have the latest reloading manuals. And I say the latest because this stuff changes all the time. So if you've got an old reloading manual from 1990 or even 2000 or even 10 years ago, maybe it's time to get the newer version of that. I have the latest manuals from Lyman, Sierra, Lee, and I have a digital version of the Hornady manual. Now, in the case of some of these, like Sierra and Hornady, they talk about their own bullets. Lyman and Lee, meanwhile, talk about other kinds of bullets. And each one of these books will dedicate basically a lot of ink to the reloading process. It will demonstrate for you in pictures and in words how to set up your equipment, how to use your equipment, what to do. Step by step, every single one of them does that. Lyman, Sierra, Lee, Hornady, any of the others that are out there that I haven't mentioned. If you get your hands on these manuals, and I would suggest having more than one, they will guide you through the process. And then, of course, there is the instructions that come with your equipment. So you want to read all that and read it again and read it again and read it again. And basically, when you're going to head to the bench to load some rounds, read it again. I can't stress that enough. And when you talk to, again, experienced reloaders, they'll tell you the same thing. The books, the data is there for a reason. It's been researched. It's been handled by experts that do this. So I trust them. I trust them. Hodgson comes out with an annual publication every year that also has the latest data, as well as they do this in magazine form. And that's a thing to get your hands on. And last and certainly not least, a couple of books out there I would suggest reading. There's a guy named M.L. McPherson. I think they call him Mick, M-I-C. Maybe it's Mike, but I think it's Mick. My wife got me a book for Christmas this year from him called Metallic Cartridge Handloading, Pursuit of the Perfect Cartridge. Let me tell you, that subtitle is exactly what it is, Pursuit of the Perfect Cartridge. Now, there's more in this book that I can comprehend. You know, I'm not an engineer, but also I learned so much from reading it. It's just a very detailed book that I think every hand loader should have in their library. Getting back to the manuals, and what I picked up from McPherson's book was to go through these manuals as much as possible and just look at all the different loads that are available for the round you're going to load and the gun you're going to fire it in. Now, you might not see all exactly the load for the gun, but you can find something similar. And for example, some of these rounds might be shot in a Marlin lever gun as opposed to a Winchester. Might be a 22-inch barrel rather than a 20. Different twist rates, those types of things. All that stuff is stuff you want to look at, study, and have fun learning it. And again, I'm comparing various loads from various rounds in there. If I'm going to shoot a Hornady bullet, I'm probably going to follow the Hornady data and use the components that they suggest. Otherwise, I might follow what's in the Lee book. The Lee book also is very intricate in terms of its reading. There's a lot of information in there that is a bit over my head, but is still worth reading, depending on your level, your engineering skill. But these books are great, and I can't suggest them enough, as well as the McPherson book. One more book we're going to talk about when we come back from a break is co-authored by Robin Sharpless, and we're going to talk more about reading and get the reloading steps from Robin right after this.
Your land is your legacy, but keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land in Vermont, Massachusetts, or New York, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News, and we're having quite the discussion on reloading. I guess it's a one-way discussion because I'm doing all the talking, but I'm trying to share with you and point out that anyone can take up reloading as long as you're willing to read, willing to learn, and pay attention to detail. I'm 2 years into this. I'm getting ready to really tackle both bottleneck and straight wall rifle cartridges, and I'm confident that I can do this because of the people I've networked with and all the research that I've done. Again, reading those manuals has been really, really informative for me. And I'm going to these manuals and basically looking how they each one of them approaches the rounds I'm going to reload for. 30-30, 30-06, and 444 Marlin are the ones I'm looking ahead at. The other thing I've done is watch a lot of videos. Robin Sharpless turned me on to a guy called 76 High Boy, and he's got quite the YouTube channel out there, and he goes step by step through reloading various cartridges. He's got an entire series on the 30-30, and I've really enjoyed him. Also, there's a guy named Ron Spomer who does a lot of writing for Outdoor News, and Ron's got quite a collection of reloading podcasts and reloading videos, and there's more and more out there. And one of the things I've heard both of them say is not even to trust them on YouTube. They'll tell you to go back to the books. And speaking of the books, Robin Sharpless, again, he's vice president with Reading Reloading out of Cortland. He co-authored a book about 10 years ago called The Handbook of Reloading Basics. And when I had Robin on the podcast not quite a year ago, we talked about this book. And I wanted to share a segment with you from that discussion. So here it is.
The Gun Digest folks had signed a contract with, of all people, Walmart to come up with a bunch of new digest-sized books for a special display that was going to be sold in Walmart stores all over the country. And when I was contacted to do the metallic half, Bob Robb did the shot shell half. What was interesting is they wanted, and we'll put it in college terms, they wanted a true 100-level book. And so it was stepping back to write a book that people who didn't even know the terms could learn from and understand. And it was a lot of fun to do, but it was also the step back because we tend to be experienced and we think, talk, and act in that experienced manner. But to take it back to the level of someone who's really never done it before. And the thing that I did very differently in my half of the book was, and people either love the idea or hate the idea, but if you go back through history and look at a lot of the beginner digests that were out there on hand loading, they teach you how to do bottleneck rifle cartridges, and then there might be a chapter at the end about what's different about doing a handgun cartridge. Well, my problem with that always was, if you don't know anything about it to begin with, that's a difficult way to teach. So my half of the book is really two books. And in some respects, some parts of it reads very much like the other. But we start with a handgun, a straight wall handgun cartridge, or we start with a bottleneck rifle cartridge. And, you know, each section begins with pick up the cartridge and take a look for it to see if there are any splits, et cetera, et cetera. So it's literally every step of each. So if you're going to just start out by learning to do 38s, why should you have to learn how to load bottleneck rifle cartridges and then get a chapter on what's different about loading a handgun cartridge? So, you know, when I designed the idea behind the book, it was really for that person that had no experience whatsoever with it to start from, you know, the first page of that section, and by the end, have a loaded round.
Okay, that was Robin Sharpless talking about a book he co-authored, The Handbook of Reloading Basics. He co-authored that book with a guy named Rick Sapp, and that book is hard to find in print form. If you want to get that one, you're going to have to get that in digital form for your Kindle or your phone or something like that, which is fairly inexpensive, but it comes highly recommended. And even on 76 High Boys video, he's got a hard copy of that, and I saw him holding it up one time and, you know, saying this is a really good reference. So getting back to Robin, about a year ago when we had him on the podcast, we talked about the basic steps of reloading and kind of how simple it is. Again, if you pay attention to what you're doing, have done some research, and are very meticulous in your measurements. With that, anyone can do this reloading. And here's Robin from a year ago to tell you about the process.
What you really are looking at here is, you know, every time you pull a trigger, you wind up with an empty case, which is generally the most important, most expensive component of the round that you just used. And it's really simple, or relatively simple. And it is the idea of simply replacing the components that have been expended in a logical process and with an eye towards always good measurements and proper utilization of the powders, et cetera. So really what we have is, you know, it's almost like firing a round backwards. You know, when we fire a round, we pull the trigger and it hits the hammer hits the firing pin, which hits the primer then expends itself by creating, and I'll use the cool term, the brissance, which is the technical term for the flame that comes out of the primer, igniting the powder, burning the powder, creating the pressure that then pushes the bullet down the barrel. So what we're going to talk, and while this is all happening, the brass itself obtruates, which is a fancy name for saying it swells up to fill the chamber, seal itself, and then it springs back a little bit and releases so you can remove it from the chamber. So starting at that end, what do we have to do first? We have to take that piece of brass and we have to resize it back to where it needs to be so it will fit any chamber. We get it back to the spec of where it's supposed to be. And we do that on a reloading press with a sizing die, a full-length sizing die that not only sizes the neck and pushes the shoulder back, but also sizes the body and all the other parts. At the same time, that die generally punches out the primer. There's our second part that we have to take care of. Next step is going to be to reprime. And one of the critical things that we need to deal with is the idea of making sure we have appropriate neck tension to hold that bullet when we're done. Brass wall thickness has a SAMI spec that where it can vary some. So that's why if you notice on your decapping rod, you generally have, we call it an expander button or an expander ball or just an expander, depending on who the company is. What happens is that die is sizing the outside of the neck down to a diameter that will create an inside diameter that will still hold the bullet on the thinnest SAMI spec neck wall. Well, in reality, most brass is thicker than that. So that expander button pulls back through, reopening the neck to the proper dimension, usually 1.5 to 2,000 smaller than bullet diameter, to give you a good neck tension. So what are we going to do next? Well, we got to put that new primer in. So we'll put the new primer in. Then we have to put our powder in. So first we want to look at a good powder data manual, determine what powder is appropriate for what we want to do. It's not simply the cartridge, but it's also the weight of bullet we want to fire through that cartridge. So we'll get our powder. We need a powder scale to measure our powder with. So far we've got a press that we need to have. We've got a set of dies. And I say a set, we've only talked about the sizing die thus far. The press generally will have an arm that will allow you to seat primers. So that's part of the process. And now we need to get into the powder. And the powder has to be measured very, very precisely. So a powder scale is an absolute necessity. You don't have to have a fancy powder thrower, but if you have a scale, a plastic spoon, and then what's called a powder trickler, you're going to be in good shape. So what we'll do is we'll take our plastic spoon, because we don't want to have anything that could be could create electrostatic energy and make a spark that could ignite anything. We're going to come put some in our powder pan until it comes up to where we're just shy of where we should be. And then that trickler, a trickler is a device which allows you to turn a knob and dispense just a few grains of powder at a time. And we use that to come up to our, basically to zero our scale and come up to the place where we have the exact load that we want. After that, we need a powder funnel. And a powder funnel is a funnel on the top, and it's a funnel on the bottom too. So it's reversed, so it'll go onto the neck of the case and allow the powder to go in. So we now put our powder in, and now we move over to our next die. And our next die is going to be our seating die, which generally also has a crimp in it as well. And the seating die is designed to help you seat that bullet. Inside of it, it's got a what's called a seat plug that has an area in it which will contact part of the ogive of the bullet so that it's pushed in straight. But critically, we also need to make sure that we seat that bullet to the proper depth and wind up with the proper overall length that's safe for the gun and safe for the round. It's more than just fitting in the magazine, but we'll do that using a set of dial calipers or electronic calipers. And they're available even at hardware stores or Tractor Supply or even Harbor Freight for relatively inexpensive prices. That said, we're going to pick our bullet. We've measured our powder based on our bullet weight, and then we'll start the seating process by intentionally seating it a little bit long and then working down to the point where we have it seated to the right depth. We do that by checking it with the caliper. When we're at that correct depth, we then lock, using a lock ring, that seat plug into position. And we're off to the races with seating. Now, when seating's done, if we wish to crimp, what we will then do is use the same die, but we'll back the seat plug out of the equation and then turn the die and then take a loaded round with a bullet in it, turn the die down until we can feel the crimp ring in the die starting to contact the mouth of the case on the top of the neck of the case, and then turn in a little bit, seat, take a look, turn a little bit more until we have a nice solid crimp. When that's done, then we'll lock the die body back down and we can go through and crimp all of those that we've already seated. At that point in time, we've got a box of ammo or more, depending on how much time you took.
We hope you enjoyed that little segment from a year ago of Robin Sharpless talking about the process of hand loading a cartridge from start to finish. And that's going to conclude our little discussion here on getting started in reloading and this episode of the Great Northeast Podcast. Wherever you are, we hope you're getting outside this winter, enjoying yourself. Maybe you're getting to some of the shows we talked about earlier. Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, we hope you had a big buck on your meat pole and you're going to have a big fish in your net. For New York Outdoor News and the Great Northeast Podcast, I'm Dan Ladd.
Missed a past episode of the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast? You can find previous programs at outdoornews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platform. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover on this program, get yourself a subscription to Outdoor News. Simply call 800-535-5191 or visit us at outdoornews.com. And don't forget to join us again here in 2 weeks to talk everything out of doors. Thanks for listening to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast.